This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The Triangle is booming. Raleigh's one of the fastest growing cities in the country, and that creates some challenges. Just ask the Wake County School Board what it's like to deal with growth in double digits over just 10 years. For one thing, it means building more schools, and that means moving students around, and that upsets parents. Same is true for Chapel Hill Carborough. They're building a new elementary school in that district. It means hundreds of students are going to be reassigned, and the school board is facing some angry parents. They're protesting the findings of a report that recommends the creation of a magnet school to consolidate multiple Spanish language programs. The report also calls for an end to the Chinese dual language program. Dave DeWitt is WUNC's education reporter, and he joins me in the studio now. Welcome back, Dave.
Hi, Frank.
Also on the program, Claudia Cervantes-Soon, an associate professor in the School of Education at UNC Chapel Hill. Claudia, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you.
We're taking phone calls this hour, 877-962-9862, emails at sot@wunc.org. So, Dave, let's get some of the details of the situation now at Chapel Hill Carborough.
Well, as you mentioned, Frank, they're opening a new school soon, the 11th elementary school in the north side district or area of Chapel Hill. And as they're doing that, they want to take a look at sort of all of their programs. They not only just have to sort of redraw attendance zones, they want to look to see if there are things they can do to consolidate some programs, maybe offer some opportunities to people who haven't been able to get them before. So in doing that, they looked at their dual language programs, and currently they have some Spanish language dual language programs in three of the elementary schools, and then a Mandarin Chinese program in one of them. The idea that they put forward was to create one magnet school for Spanish English language dual language program, the entire school at Frank Porter Graham, and then phase out the Mandarin Chinese program. They put this forward in a report for public comment, and they got plenty of it from people who disagreed with those two.
And what's the source? Let's stick with the consolidation now, the Spanish program, for just a minute. You know, on the face of it, consolidating a program, making a magnet school, that part of it sounds pretty sensible. What's the objection, and what happens when the plan hits the ground?
Most people agree with that sentiment, that it is sensible to do that. And most people within dual language will say a magnet school is better than having a single program at a school. And, you know, we should say, sort of back up, that dual language programs are all over the state, and they range from being one classroom at one school to being full-on magnet schools at different places. So most people agree that that's a pretty good sentiment. But as what usually happens when you start looking at magnet programs, nobody wants it at their particular school, because a school is a community. And they've picked Frank Porter Graham School for possible magnet status, which would mean it would displace the people who are there now to go to other schools, so that the seats could be made available for people to come from throughout the district to go to that magnet school.
Sure. So if you weren't in the Spanish immersion program, but that was your local, the closest school, you would lose your seat to somebody who was going to take Spanish.
That's right. And you'd end up at one of the other elementary schools. And when they do this in other places, most notably Wake County, you get a lot of people who complain about being out of their, you know, forced out of their school community to make magnet program seats available.
All right. And then the Mandarin program, what's going on with that?
Well, the Mandarin program has been around for several years now. And just what it says, it's a dual language program, teaches Mandarin, Chinese, and English. And it's an elementary school program. And the idea was that it hasn't been, it's a good program. Most people agree it's been a great program, but that it hasn't had to support. There are some things, challenges in that kind of program that, getting teachers, getting textbooks in Mandarin. It's the kind of program, honestly, that you have to be all in. You have to devote a tremendous amount of resources to it to make it really successful. And if you do it halfway, then you're going to have mixed results. And so there are two ways you can go. And one way is to expand it, make it better, really throw some resources into it, or to phase it out. And this particular report, the first report, I should say, suggested that phasing it out would be a better idea.
We're going to spend the rest of the hour investigating some of the controversy around these proposals, but let's take a broader look just for a moment. And Claudia, let me ask you about dual language immersion programs in general and ask you how they work.
Okay, yes, Frank. Well, dual language immersion programs, which are also called two-way immersion, or some people call them dual language or dual immersion, these are a model of bilingual education in which language majority and language minority students learn together and from each other. The goal of these programs is bilingualism and biliteracy and long-term academic achievement for both groups. And so dual language immersion programs have several components. The most important one is the integration of majority and minority language students, as I mentioned before, with each group encompassing about 50% of the class. Together, they learn literacy and subjects in both languages. And because of the goal of is bilingualism and biliteracy, the program lasts at least from 5 to 6 years, starting kindergarten or first grade. Some start even in pre-kindergarten. And in some cases, they continue all the way to middle school and high school. Now, there are several variations of dual language immersion. Two are especially common. The 50-50 model, as the term implies, teaches all subjects in both languages using more or less equal amounts of English in the minority language throughout the program. And then there's also the 90-10 model, which begins with 90% in the minority language instruction in the early years and up to like first grade, and then it phases English in gradually, getting to a 50-50 split in the languages by grades 4 through 6. Both models stress language separation, and they have been pretty successful. This language separation is opposed to like a current translation, concurrent translation, so that students will focus on the lesson that they're being taught in their weaker language rather than waiting for the version of the same content in their native language. And so the goal is to make second language input comprehensible, as in sheltered instruction, which has been used for many years in ESL. These same principles are being applied in both of the languages, because there's always a group of students that is learning in a second language.
So is the let me ask you this. Is the impetus behind this and the goal about assimilation, or is it considered enrichment?
This is considered an enrichment program. And it's interesting because dual language programs evolved from other bilingual education programs, which had a more assimilationist goal. And they evolved from them precisely because educators were concerned that students were losing, or language minority students were losing their native language in their efforts to learn English. And so dual language immersion programs promised to maintain, to help students maintain their native language while learning a second language.
Has dual language been politicized then since the beginning? If you're talking about assimilation, I would think that there's always been a political component.
Yes, most definitely. Well, like I mentioned, I should probably give you a little bit of history of how these programs emerged.
Sure.
The first models of dual language immersion dates back to 1963 at the Coral Way School in Miami, and the program was started by Cuban citizens who were seeking refuge in Florida from the Castro regime, and believed that their children should or would eventually return to Cuban schools, so they wanted their children to maintain their Spanish while learning English. But then in the 70s, similar experiments began to emerge. But what happened was that during the civil rights movement, with the passage of Title VII of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, or the Bilingual Education Act, as we know it, the needs of limited English-speaking ability students were for the first time recognized by federal policy. And so the Bilingual Education Act provided school districts with federal funds in the form of competitive grants to establish bilingual programs. And then in 1974, the Lau versus Nichols civil rights case provided opportunities to further opportunities to language minority students by charging schools with a mission to implement programs suitable to the needs of their language minority students. So schools had this responsibility, right? The problem was that The bilingual education programs, while a positive thing, they were perceived as remedial programs, right? Mm-hmm. They were perceived as programs that were intended to fix something that was wrong with with language minority students rather than seeing them as having assets and resources.
So if you create this immersion program where both the language minority and the majority students are benefiting, then it's seen as in a whole new light.
Exactly. And so educators saw this opportunity. Why can't we have both groups together? And that way we are not segregating language minority students, which is something that happened in bilingual education models. We allow them to maintain their language because we will continually teach bilingually, and we will not exit students after 3 years, which is what was happening in most of the bilingual education programs. And so while it started, with more deficit-oriented views, this dual language immersion programs gave that opportunity to turn them into enrichment programs where children of both groups are perceived as learners but also as contributors. And you have also the opportunity to raise the minority language to a higher status.
On the State of Things today, talking about dual language immersion programs with WUNC's education reporter Dave DeWitt, Claudia Cervantes Soon from UNC School of Education. Coming up, we'll talk about a language minority group that does not speak English as a first language nor Spanish and how they might be affected by the proposals at the Chapel Hill Carborough School System. We'll do that on the State of Things and take your phone calls at 877-962-9862. On the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about dual language education, the Chapel Hill Carborough School District is considering turning Frank Porter Graham into a magnet school for Spanish dual language immersion. They also might discontinue the dual language immersion program in Mandarin Chinese. Dave DeWitt, WUNC's education reporter, he's in the studio. Claudia Cervantes Soon is a professor at UNC's School of Education. She's with us by phone, and you can be with us by phone as well if you call 877-962-9862 or send us an email at sot@wunc.org. So, Dave, we've been talking about language minority students in immersion. There's one group at Frank Porter Graham now that might be affected by this, and they speak neither English nor Spanish as their first language.
Right. They speak a language called Karen. They're Myanmar refugees. And what's interesting about Frank Porter Graham Elementary School is one of the reasons that it was picked for possibly becoming the magnet in Chapel Hill is because it has what's called a small walk zone. There are not many students who live within the area in which they walk and not ride the bus, but one group that does live inside the walk zone is this group you're talking about here, the Karen-speaking group. So, this is a group of students who have been well-educated at Frank Porter Graham. The staff is accustomed to their special needs. They've had a good experience there by all accounts. So there's a lot of question. Okay, what happens to this group if they then become, sent out of this school into a different elementary school? And Chapel Hill has a long history of taking care of all of its residents educationally. It's a community that values education very strongly, pays for it at a higher rate than any other district in the state. But there is a concern about what happens to students. And Frank Porter Graham has the highest concentration of students on free and reduced price lunch of any elementary school in that district. So a lot of the concerns about moving students out of Frank Porter Graham and into other schools centers around this Karen group, but also a lot of the other low-income students.
Claudia, let's talk again about immersion and its value. What about the research? What does it tell us about the value of this kind of education for the students who participate?
Well, yeah, there have been numerous studies conducted all over the U.S. With most of the studies being in California, Massachusetts, and Texas. But the results really have found very positive outcomes in most of the studies, even the large-scale studies. Pedagogically, there are several reasons why we would like to have the students together integrated in this way in an immersion program. First, you're interacting. The language minority students are able to interact with native speakers, of course, and you reduce that segregation. But also they have access to better models and more models of language proficiency for both groups. You also are giving them the opportunity to develop cross-cultural sensitivity and global awareness. And again, it's about enrichment rather than remediation. Now, some of the studies that have been conducted have found that the 90-10 model is probably one of the most successful ones. And this is perhaps because you provide more time on task for native English speakers in the minority language. And these programs also provide a longer period of time for language learners to acquire the second language. So these tend to be a little more successful, but they all have shown pretty good results. Another very promising result that has been found is that they tend to help language minority students develop more positive attitudes towards education and aspirations to college. They reduce dropout rates. And this might be related to the fact that language minority students are raised to a higher status. They are experiencing an education where there's higher expectations for them, but where they also contribute.
Well, I want to introduce Makeba Wilborn right now. She's an assistant professor at Duke in the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience. She's conducting a longitudinal study of Spanish dual language immersion at Southwest Elementary in Durham. This is her third year. Makeba, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about that. You're interested in the cognitive aspect of these programs. So talk about what's happening to a child's brain on dual language. This is your brain on two languages.
Right. Well, my initial interest was in looking at the research in the cognitive area where we were finding that what we call crib bilinguals who were learning two languages from home mm-hmm. before school entry, were showing clear benefits in cognitive abilities, in particular in attention and executive function, which is sort of like, I call it the card dealer of attention. It sort of divvies up how you allocate your attention to particular tasks. And this research had been really clear in establishing these benefits. And the question for me when I started thinking about kids in dual immersion was, when do these benefits emerge? Is it something that you have to have early in before you learn language, pre-verbally as an infant or toddler? Or is it something that you can acquire as you get older? And then the question for me of interest was, do you have to reach a certain level of proficiency in the second language and then boom, a light switch goes off and now you have these cognitive benefits? Is it an intensity question? So if you have a year of intense input, does that sort of give you the benefits? Or is it a prolonged, where if you have a little bit of input over a long period of time?
Right.
So these were the questions that I was interested in. And this also co-occurred at a time where I put my daughter in the dual immersion program. So it seemed like a great time to start asking these questions. So what we did was, we've been looking at these cognitive abilities, executive function, using various tasks. That are one task that I created is actually using auditory input in language. And then we're using two tasks that are not based on language. So how they visually make decisions and shift their attention and make choices. And so what we did was, we started in the spring of 2010 and we tested the kindergartners through fourth graders in the dual immersion and also a room of the same age group in the traditional. And we did a series of tests, vocabulary tests, phonological awareness tests, and these executive function tests. And the data so far are pretty interesting and exciting. And when we look at the kindergartners, it's consistent with research done by Andy Meltzoff and Stephanie Carlson that we don't really see differences there with about a year of exposure. But by first and second grade, we're starting to see that the kids in the dual immersion are both more accurate as well as more efficient in processing information. So they're faster at making responses and they're also more accurate.
And again, you're checking for, because what's interesting, and I think what's at the heart of your testing, is whether or not it's it's your ability to know two languages, which or the fact that you're sitting in this room having to struggle through this class, whether you're good at it or not. Are you able to get a fix on that? Does just being there, struggling with this, make you a sharper thinker and better at these executive process or this process?
Well, the first thing is we know very little about this particular population. As it is, we're still learning a great deal about how crib bilinguals are sort of acquiring two languages and what the mechanism is that's actually facilitating these cognitive enhancements. So we know very little about that with sort of the crib bilinguals. We know even less about what it looks like for kids who are, you know, learning two languages in school. But one of the thinking that we have in the field right now is that this idea of inhibition, you know, when you're listening in one language, you have to inhibit the other. And also the notion of monitoring. You have to monitor the environment and focus your attention appropriately on the things that you need to focus on and ignore the things that you don't. And I like to use the analogy of taking notes in a lecture, right? And if you're taking notes in a lecture, you have to ignore the guy next to you who's, you know, texting or Facebooking. But you also have to be able to pay attention to what the teacher's still saying, even though you're writing what she previously said, and update as you sort of shift back to the lecture, update and catch up. And we find that bilinguals in general are better at both attention control and shifting attention as well as updating. So one of the things that we're thinking about in our research, my collaborator and I, Brenda Kalia at Worcester State, is that it's just the act of inhibiting your dominant language and attending to the less dominant language and going back and forth and having to shift back and forth as well as update what the teacher says. And that doing that over and over in many ways fine-tunes the brain, and it's sort of like you're greasing the wheels. And that act in and of itself may, it appears, sort of transfers across domains to different types of aspects.
It does sound like what we had called either enrichment or remediation should be what we call education. This is how we should do school for everybody. Yeah, but we don't, and probably cost has something to do with it. Dave, let's get back to the controversy at Chapel Hill, at Carrboro a little bit. So the magnet school at Frank Porter Graham, of course, is part of the controversy. Students there might be displaced if it were to become a magnet school. And the thing that parents are looking at is this new school that's going up. Why not there? So talk a little bit about the new school and why not, what the school board says about that.
Well, opening a new school is an interesting problem and challenge. And most of the times it's a good thing because you're alleviating crowding. You're doing some other, you know, a new school always looks good. A lot of politicians come out to cut the ribbon. But what it forces you to do as a school district is redraw lines. And whenever you redraw lines, that means that some parents and some families are going to be going places that were different. And no matter what school district you're in the country, that's going to draw out some people who don't like it. They like the school they're in. They like the schedule. They like everything about it. They love the teachers. They don't want to move. So you sort of separate that out from the folks who then in this particular disagreement, I guess you'd call it, who you know, don't want to be, they've been in a program, they've adopted it, and families have to take on a lot. When they go into a dual language program, if they have to, you know, you commit to a lot. You commit to being in the same classroom with the same kids as they move along, but you also commit to doing some things at home in a language you may not be familiar with necessarily. So it's a commitment, and these families were asked to make a commitment in certain places, especially thinking about the Mandarin program. And now suddenly they want to phase that out. That you can understand that issue. So there's really two things at work. When you open a new school, it causes you to rethink about all of these things, especially in a district the size of Chapel Hill. You know, you open a new school in Wake County with so many more students. It might affect the contiguous schools, but it's not going to affect necessarily schools farther away. In Chapel Hill, it's going to affect every single one of the existing 10 elementary schools. So, there are a lot of conversations that occur. There are a lot of people who agree and disagree. And almost always you see parents come out and say, we don't want change. Mm-hmm. And then when change is sort of thrust upon them, they don't like it. And then eventually that sort of fades away. It happened a lot in Wake County when we talk about the schedule, year-round schedules. People hated the year-round schedules, the idea of it. then they did it. And now when they, you know, actually Wayne County, they're starting to change some schedules back to from year round to regular, and they don't want to change back now.
Back.
So
right.
there's some of that going on. But you know, you can understand the other side too, the dual language component of it.
Well, we have two concerned parents with us on the program today. Omar Zinn has two children at Frank Porter Graham Elementary in Chapel Hill. David Saucy has a daughter in the Mandarin Immersion Program at Glenwood Elementary School in Chapel Hill. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
So, Omar, what concerns you about this proposed change at Frank Porter Graham?
I'm a member of the school improvement team. I've been a member of the school improvement team now for 3 years. I have two children there, as you mentioned. And my biggest concern with this recommendation is how it was done, the pace in which it was made, and the four criteria that they based their decision off of. No one at Frank Porter Graham knew that there was a committee formed to create a recommendation, even though there were several other elementary schools invited to the discussion table who have dual language programs. We were not aware of this discussion, and then all of a sudden we get a bunch of recommendations handed down to us. You're basing, you know, a major decision on four criteria, I just feel like Frank Porter Graham is a very complex, very diverse school. We certainly have had our struggles with AYP in terms of academic yearly performance. But we have a new leader, Dr. Rita Bongarden, who has completely turned around our school in many different ways. We, last year, were a school of distinction. We showed 28% improvement in our achievement gap. That is measured from the highest achievers to the lowest achievers, measured scholastically and academically. And so, you know, we're a school that's on the rise, that is seeing great improvement. And now all of a sudden, you know, a quick haste decision is made. Let's do things right. Let's not do them fast.
Well, is there anything about those improvements that you think is threatened with if Frank Porter Graham were to become a magnet school?
Well, certainly. For many of the parents that I speak with, it's not so much about redistricting. You know, we have a wonderful staff who have stuck with the school through, you know, numerous administrations, who have poured their heart out and put everything that they have into this school. And now all of a sudden, your job might be on the line. I know many teachers are already applying for other jobs at other schools. So let's say, in June, when the vote will come down, if the school board decides to turn Frank Porter Graham into a DL magnet, well, we're going to lose a lot of our staff that have really put so much time into the school. And then next year, we're going to get brand new staff, a lot of new people who, you know, have no experience with our population. The Karen, as Dave mentioned earlier, these are people who refugee status, who have been shot at, fled from their villages, bombed from above. Bombed by helicopters, flooded from their land, and now they finally made it to, you know, a safe haven, to Frank Porter Graham, that has become their village. And you know, we understand differentiated teaching because we have many different subgroups at Frank Porter Graham, and the Korean are just one of those many subgroups that I think that, you know, we really want to look out for.
David Saucy, let's talk about the Chinese program for a minute, and then we'll continue our conversation about all of these potential changes in Chapel Hill, Carrboro. Tell us about your concerns about discontinuing the Mandarin program.
So our concerns about discontinuing the program are driven by our opinion that the district and the school board are looking at the program through the wrong lens. They're very focused on low English proficiency and the achievement gap and measuring this program in that way, and they seem to have come up with the conclusion that it's difficult to run, and it's expensive, and it's not, and from their view, it's not really having as much impact there as it could be. But we think that I think broadly in the case of dual language instruction, and particularly in the case of Mandarin dual language instruction in Chapel Hill, is that you should really be looking at it as a great tool for preparing our kids for being successful in the 21st century in the world that they're going to graduate into, where in the United States, I think it's it's obvious now, and I think even more so in the future, that there'll be three important languages to be proficient, to have proficiency in the United States: Spanish, English, and Chinese, too, to really be successful in the world. So it's almost as if they've said, you know, this is difficult. It's not achieving these goals, so let's just chuck it out. We actually think that they're looking at it through the wrong lens, and that it's an important program to continue and to provide this educational asset for kids throughout the district. It's not just in our one school. It actually provides this for kids throughout the district.
Dave DeWitt, was there anything in the report that suggested if the program wasn't meeting its goals, did it suggest what it would take to do that?
Well, I think the goals that it oftentimes is judged upon have to do with the achievement gap and some of those things that. And I think the point that school board members would make is that, there are things these programs are developed for a small percentage of the students and not necessarily for the broader student body. And creating a magnet school would open those up to broader, a broader population. But there is a lot of question. And I think there's a lot of viable questions and challenges about sort of, how do you judge a Mandarin program? And do you judge it by test scores of the students? Do you judge it by, do you think about this? And it was created, I believe, because they wanted to broaden out and have this kind of language experience. But then, there are the harsh realities of education in this state, unfortunately, where you start looking at things like achievement gap and you start looking at things like test scores. And that's where some of that comes in. Do you judge by test scores? Do you judge on sort of a more broader sense?
On the state of things today, dual language immersion programs, Chapel Hill Carrboro District considering creating a magnet school for Spanish language immersion and ending the current Chinese program. We will come back after a short break and take your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking about the efficiency and importance of dual language immersion programs. Dave DeWitt, WUNC's education reporter. Claudia Cervantes Soon is an associate professor in the School of Education at UNC Chapel Hill. Makiba Wilborn is an assistant professor at Duke in the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience. And also with us on the program today, Omar Zinn on the school improvement team at Frank Porter Graham. He is with us, as is Dave Saucy, who has a child in the Chinese immersion program. And now, Omar, your daughter was part of that class in the Spanish immersion program, was she not?
She was, yes. I went before the school board to petition the school board to bring a DL program to Frank Porter Graham. And let me just state for the record, I am fully in favor of bilingual or dual language programs. What I'm against is the dismantling of Frank Porter Graham and dispersing our community and turning Frank Porter Graham into a dual language magnet when I think there are other viable alternatives.
Dave, give us an idea of the scope about how many students are going to be displaced. What happens to the staff? Any idea what would happen?
Well, Frank Porter Graham has about, I think, 430 or so students in it. It's one of the smaller elementary schools in Chapel Hill. They range from about 430 or so to upwards of 600. The big question is, why can't they make the new school they're building into the magnet school? And building a new school, very different school districts put different levels of sort of strategy, and a lot of times it just has to do with where is the space, and we stick the school where we can fit it. Mm-hmm. It's always been my sense that Chapel Hill schools have done a lot of background in sort of figuring out, okay, where's the best place for a school? Land is expensive in Chapel Hill. How do we put it there? It would have a bigger walk zone, the new school would, they said, than Frank Porter Graham does. So that's one of the reasons they'd rather create a magnet school. If you look at Wake County, a lot of the magnet schools are downtown. And Wake County not only created a lot of magnet schools to broaden out their education programs, but they use it to enhance diversity. And that's a big tool for them, is so that they can get suburban kids coming from the outskirts of Raleigh to come downtown. And then a lot of the downtown kids, they ended up moving sort of to the suburbs. So that was their tool there. That's not necessarily the case in Chapel Hill, where they use a magnet school for diversity. It's much more about the educational opportunities being available to all the students in all the schools.
Is this something that happens only in the Triangle? How much of this goes on in the rest of the state?
Magnet schools or dual language programs?
Dual language.
Yeah. It's all over the state. And it's, it's in the urban districts. It's in the rural districts. If you look at Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, where they have more neighborhood schools, but they've created two language academies small schools, which are fully, you know, one is fully Spanish-English magnet school. One has multiple languages in it. And that model is generally seen as being, you get, there's more support in general for an entire school. Teachers get better training. The atmosphere is better. The cultural resources can be better than if you have, one of four elementary school classes is the dual language and the rest aren't. And when you have that kind of program, then you get a lot of sort of politics within the school itself.
Well, Claudia Cervantes, soon give us an idea, if you know, what impact dual language programs have on a school for those who don't participate in the program itself. Does it have any impact on the rest of the school, on the way things are taught and on the way other students understand language and education?
Yes, well, typically what researchers have seen is that there is more of an appreciation of diversity, and that's why perhaps, they're used as magnet programs like this. It's not just an appreciation of the language or bilingualism, but an appreciation of minority groups as well. So this is perhaps one of the most important things. Another thing is that it really helps with raising the scores, of course, because typically students in dual language programs tend to outperform students in the regular mainstream programs or in ESL programs. So they tend to make a school look a lot better, and it raises the status of the whole school, the whole community. Everybody feels better about their school, so they do much better.
Makiba, is that because those higher test scores, because the people who tend to get into those programs may have tested higher coming in, or there's something about the program that raised their scores?
Well, We were considering that, and I think that it's important to remember that you have two very different populations coming into a dual immersion. You have the native Spanish speaking population, which is often lower income, and then you also have often traditionally a middle income white population as the native English speaking population. So within a dual immersion classroom or program, you often have two very different cultural groups. Not just in language, but also in socioeconomic status. But what we found is we controlled for parent education and existing vocabulary, and the cognitive benefits were still there for both groups.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones now. James is on the line from Fayetteville. Hello, James.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Got a question for us?
I do. I'm kind of baffled. It just sounds like it's totally cost, an issue of cost and just a money issue. But has there ever been an attempt in that school to maybe merge with corporate partners who could possibly come in and help save that program and enhance the foreign language components of it?
You're talking now about the Mandarin program?
Oh, well, the Mandarin or the Spanish immersion, but mostly the Mandarin, because
yeah.
I just really see that as a major need for our students who are going to be competing in the global market. It just doesn't make sense to me what's going on.
All right, James, thank you very much. Dave, do you know if they've tackled how they deal with the cost issue?
I don't specifically know about the Mandarin program, if there if there have been some businesses that have come in. But there have been situations like that across the state where you've seen businesses have come in. A lot of times it's with sort of through their foundations. Sometimes it's more about human resources, people who are working. But the cost issue in more of a broad sense is really interesting because, statewide, the state is looking at losing about $255 million this year from the federal government, which was, EduJobs money that was used to save teacher jobs, as many as 5,000 teachers. And that, that's a pressure that's sort of big and giant and unrelenting on every school board here in the state. And these dual language programs cost money. They cost more money than a traditional curriculum. So you've got to have people who run the programs. You've got to hire dual language teachers, which oftentimes can be harder to find and bring in and to train. That sort of loss of money. And Chapel Hill is not immune from that. We think of Chapel Hill as being a wealthy district that has resources other districts don't, and that's true. But they're not immune from these kinds of, you talk about $255 million statewide. That's going to affect every single school district. So as you think about the fate of all these dual language programs and magnet programs and everything else, and magnet schools are more expensive than traditional schools too. So that's sort of this overriding pressure on all of them.
Well, let me ask the question. I think I made an assertion earlier on but didn't really get a response. So let me do that now. Makiba, I'll start with you and then Claudia ask you, should this be what education, should this be how everybody, you know, gets their education given what we see about the improved outcomes?
Well, I mean, I think from my standpoint, the benefits are definitely important for education. You know, executive function in particular is a predictor of school outcomes and success. I think the reason why this hasn't been sort of used more globally is, one, political issues pertaining to the populations, but two, also because we're still relatively new in the field, especially in terms of the cognitive aspects and learning more and more about it. But I think, you know, the Thomas and Collier study that really was largely based on the Chapel Hill district, you know, the outcomes are clear. It closes the gap. It's beneficial. And, you know, most of the data are consistent in that way. So,
Claudia, what do you think? Thank you.
Yes, I agree. Absolutely. I think that if we were able to provide this to all students, we would certainly do so in many schools which are really interested in doing it. But I think it's also a lot of different challenges, like teacher recruitment and that sort of thing, that really make it difficult. So it's not a lack of interest for many schools. It is a lack of resources or a lack of teachers, prepared teachers. And then, of course, you know, conflicts of interest. And this is perhaps the most important or one of the most difficult challenges to really balance the power relationships between communities, because we have differing status and resources in communities. We have parents with conflicting priorities, educators with very professional interests, and children with different experiences. And all of this must be managed skillfully to ensure success. So it is a balancing act. There are some parents that may come with more educational skills to the table, who might be a little more vocal and whose interests are given priority, as compared to other parents who typically tend to be language minority parents with less resources. So, you know, you have all of those challenges. So it is not that we don't want to provide this type of education to all students, but that it is very difficult to manage. You need a very strong leaders, very well-prepared leaders in dual language as well as teachers, and you really need a buy-in from the whole community.
Right. Well, David Saucy?
So I think I can address a couple of points here with respect to the Mandarin program, at least, and that is I think there's no question that it is more challenging to recruit, particularly in elementary education, Mandarin-speaking teachers who are highly qualified to teach elementary education in North Carolina. It's more challenging to do that than it is to recruit a regular elementary school education teacher. But that said, I think one of the things that the school district hasn't done enough of in Chapel Hill is rely on a lot of the resources that they have here. And the parents, in response to this original report, have found other sources, other networks where we can identify qualified teachers and bring them in, and have had a lot of success in working with the district with that recently. And then above and beyond that, to the question about, you know, is it more costly and are there other sources of funding? And we have identified that there are. In fact, the program was started with a grant. That grant has long since run out, and so it's now down to the school. But we have identified other sources of grants and teachers and textbook support and translation support that, you know, they may not drive the cost down to zero, but I think they make it. These are avenues that we can have to make it a more cost effective program, if that's the lens that you want to look at it through.
Let's go to the phones again. Renee is on the line from Chapel Hill. Hello, Renee.
Hi. If the Spanish dual language program at Frank Porter Graham continues in its current form, it will continue to face many challenges. The magnet model would address many of these challenges. Having an entire school dedicated to dual language would concentrate resources and support in one location and enable teachers at each grade level to work together, thus breaking them out of their current professional isolation. Teacher recruitment and retention would likely improve, and the school within a school issues currently facing small dual language programs would vanish, and a magnet school dedicated to dual language would allow any family in the district to apply to enroll their child, significantly expanding access to the program.
Omar, what would you say to that statement?
Hey, Renee, how you doing? I know Renee. She's a parent at FPG.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when we all signed up at FPG, you know, we were told that there would be one strand of dual language. And certainly, you know, it gets tiring, you know, being in the same class or different dynamics, being in the same class year after year with the same kids. You know, there can be personality conflicts, and you're basically stuck with that kid for 6 years. So I understand, you know, the economies of scale when you put a whole bunch of dual language kids and a whole bunch of dual language parents under a dual language administration. And, you know, I think that's fine. I think it's fine to create a dual language magnet. My point is that they have not looked at the criteria. Frank Porter Graham, the one real criteria that kind of put the nail in the coffin for Frank Porter Graham is that they label us as a very small walk zone school.
Meaning most people are coming from other places. They can't walk there from their
They can't walk directly to Frank Porter Graham. But, you know, the committee did not consider the fact that Smith Level Road, which runs right up to Frank Porter Graham, which will be widened next year, is going to have sidewalks on both sides of it. There was a 2007 transportation study done that showed that there will be over 100 additional students that will be added to the rolls of the Frank Porter Graham Walk Zone. So, again, it's a nice idea to have a dual language magnet. I mean, the question is priorities. I mean, what are our priorities, you know, with the money that we spend on each student in the CHCCS? And, you know, is it a priority to spend more money per pupil on dual language? Or what about our African-American children? What about our Korean children? What about our socioeconomically disadvantaged children? So I think there's certainly equity issues that pop up. Again, I'm in favor of dual language and creating a dual language magnet school. My main point is that Frank Porter Graham is not the place. We're comprised of over 41 different children from over 41 different countries. We have diversity that people bust to create. Our representation looks more like a large city than, you know, a small village or a city like Chapel Hill. So, you know, let's keep this beautiful diversity. Let's go off of the success that we've created, and you know, let's move forward from there. But let's not rush this decision when there are other alternatives, such as additional strands at existing schools that allow children from the whole district to attend. When we are also opening a new elementary school, when there are some political issues surrounding elementary school number 11 in terms of, you know, it's not just a walk zone issue. There are certain things that I think board members feel have been promised with elementary school number 11.
Well, let me ask Dave DeWitt about this walk zone issue. I mean, why is that important, and why would you make the small walk zone your magnet school?
Well, it has to do with sort of, you know, how you build a community at a school. It has to do with how many people, you know, would be directly affected. For instance, if you get on a bus and go to FPG, what's the difference between getting on a bus and going to a different elementary school? So it's that sort of community around the corner kind of thing. Yeah. And the other thing about a dual language program and how you organize it that's important is if you enter a dual language program as a kindergartner, let's say you start with 25 kids. By third grade, in a transit community, a lot of those kids may have moved out, maybe gone, and you can't put somebody into a dual language program in third grade. So the entry point. And then you have, in a school, you might have one class of 15 kids, and then every other class has 25 or 30.
When is this decided now?
They're going to discuss it at Chapel Hill Schools board meeting tomorrow, and then a decision may come in June.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Dave DeWitt, WUNC's education reporter. Claudia Cervantes-Soon is an associate professor in the School of Education at UNC Chapel Hill. Makeba Wilborn is an assistant professor at Duke in the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience. Dave Saucy has a child in the Chinese Immersion Program at Glenwood Elementary in Chapel Hill. Omar Zinn, a parent and member of the school improvement team at Frank Porter Graham, also in Chapel Hill. And thanks for listening to our program. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We're going to be in Greensboro on Friday, and you can be there with us. Just send us an email, rsvp@wunc.org, if you want to be in the live audience in Greensboro Friday, May 18th. I'm Frank Stachow.